For me?
A narrow face, brown eyes, darkish hair. The cap comes off briefly. He scratches his head just above the hairline, then puts the cap back on. Sure, kid. He takes the card. What's your name? Brian, sir. Brian Seguin. Scratch, scratch, scratch on the card. The magic. The inscribed fire. You want to be a ball player when you grow up, Brian? The question has the feel of rote recital, and he speaks without raising his face from the card he holds in his large right hand so he can write on it with his soon-to-be magic left hand. Yes, sir. Practice your fundamentals. And hands the card back. Yes, sir. But he's already walking away. Then he's breaking into a lazy run on the fresh-cut grass as he jogs toward the bullpen with his shadow jogging along beside him. Brian? Brian? Long fingers were snapping under his nose, Mr. Gaunt's fingers. Brian came out of his daze and saw Mr. Gaunt looking at him, amused. Are you there, Brian? Sorry, Brian said and blushed. He knew he should hand the card back, hand it back and get out of here, but he couldn't seem to let it go. Mr. Gaunt was staring into his eyes, right into his head, it seemed, again, and once more he found it impossible to look away. So, Mr. Gaunt said softly, let us say, Brian, that you are the buyer. Let us say that. How much would you pay for that card? Brian felt despair like a rock slide weight his heart. All I've got is... Mr. Gaunt's left hand flew up. Shh, he said sternly. Bite your tongue. The buyer must never tell the seller how much he has. You might as well hand the vendor your wallet and turn the contents of your pockets out on the floor in the bargain. If you can't tell a lie, then be still. It's the first rule of fair trade, Brian, my boy. His eyes, so large and dark, Brian felt that he was swimming in them. There are two prices for this card, Brian. Half and half. One half is cash. The other is a deed. Do you understand? Yes, Brian said. He felt far again, far away from Castle Rock, far away from needful things, even far away from himself. The only things which were real in this far place were Mr. Gaunt's wide, dark eyes. The cash price for that 1956 autographed Sandy Koufax card is 85 cents, Mr. Gaunt said. Does that seem fair? Yes, Brian said. His voice was far and wee. He felt himself dwindling, dwindling away, and approaching the point where any clear memory would cease. Good, Mr. Gaunt's caressing voice said. Our trading has progressed well thus far. As for the deed, do you know a woman named Wilma Jerzyk, Brian? Wilma, sure, Brian said out of his growing darkness. She lives on the other side of the block from us. Yes, I believe she does, Mr. Gaunt agreed. Listen carefully, Brian. So he must have gone on speaking, but Brian did not remember what he said. The next thing he was aware of was Mr. Gaunt shooing him gently out onto Main Street, telling him how much he had enjoyed meeting him, and asking him to tell his mother and all his friends that he had been well treated and fairly dealt with. Sure, Brian said. He felt bewildered, but he also felt very good, as if he had just awakened from a refreshing early afternoon nap. And come again, Mr. Gaunt said, just before he shut the door. Brian looked at it. The sign hanging there now read, Closed. It seemed to Brian that he had been in needful things for hours, but the clock outside the bank said it was only 10 of 4. It had been less than 20 minutes. He prepared to mount his bike, then leaned the handlebars against his belly while he reached into his pants pocket. From one, he drew 6 bright copper pennies. From the other, he drew the autographed Sandy Koufax card. They apparently had made some sort of deal, although Brian could not for the life of him remember exactly what it had been, only that Wilma Jerzyk's name had been mentioned. To my good friend Brian, with best wishes, Sandy Koufax. Whatever deal they had made, this was worth it. A card like this was worth practically anything. Brian tucked it carefully into his knapsack so it wouldn't get bent, mounted his bike, and began to pedal home fast. He grinned all the way. When a new shop opens in a small New England town, the residents, hicks though they may be and many other things, display a cosmopolitan attitude which their city cousins can rarely match. In New York or Los Angeles, a new gallery may attract a little knot of might-be patrons and simple lookers-on before the doors are opened for the first time. A new club may even garner a line and police barricades with paparazzi armed with gadget bags and telephoto lenses standing expectantly beyond them. There is an excited hum of conversation as among theatergoers on Broadway before the opening of a new play which, smash hit or drop dead flop, is sure to cause comment. When a new shop opens in a small New England town, there is rarely a crowd before the doors open and never a line. When the shades are drawn up, the doors unlocked, and the new concern declared open for business, customers come and go in a trickle which would undoubtedly strike an outsider as apathetic and probably as an ill omen for the shopkeeper's future prosperity. What seems like a lack of interest often masks keen anticipation and even keener observation. Cora Rusk and Myra Evans were not the only two women in Castle Rock who had kept the telephone lines buzzing about needful things in the weeks before it opened. That interest and anticipation do not change the small town shopper's conservative code of conduct, however. Certain things are simply not done, particularly not in the tight Yankee enclaves north of Boston. These are societies which exist for 9 months of every year, mostly sufficient unto themselves, and it is considered bad form to show too much interest too soon, or in any way to indicate that one has felt more than a passing interest, so to speak. Investigating a new shop in a small town and attending a socially prestigious party in a large city are both activities which cause a fair amount of excitement among those likely to participate, and there are rules for both. Rules which are unspoken, immutable, and strangely similar. The chief among these is that one must not arrive first. Of course, someone has to break this cardinal rule, or no one would arrive at all. But a new shop is apt to stand empty for at least 20 minutes after the closed sign in the window has been turned over to read open for the first time. And a knowledgeable observer would feel safe in wagering that the first arrivals would come in a group, a pair, a trio, but more likely a foursome of ladies. The second rule is that the investigating shoppers display a politeness so complete that it verges on iciness. The third is that no one must ask, on the first visit at least, for the new shopkeeper's history or bona fides. The fourth is that no one should bring a welcome-to-town present, especially one as tacky as a homemade cake or pie. The last rule is as immutable as the first. One must not depart last. This stately gavotte, which might be called the dance of female investigation, lasts anywhere from 2 weeks to 2 months and does not apply when someone from town opens a business. That sort of opening is apt to be like an old home week church supper, informal, cheery, and quite dull. But when the new tradesman is from away, it is always said that way so one can hear the capital letters, the dance of female investigation is as sure as the fact of death and the force of gravity. When the trial period is over, no one takes out an ad in the paper to say that it is, but somehow everyone knows, one of two things happens. Either the flow of trade becomes more normal and satisfied customers bring in belated welcome gifts and invitations to come and visit, or the new business fails. In towns like Castle Rock, small businesses are sometimes spoken of as broke down months or even weeks before the hapless owners discover the fact for themselves. There was at least one woman in Castle Rock who did not play by the accepted rules, immutable as they might seem to others. This was Polly Chalmers, who ran You So-and-So. Ordinary behavior was not expected of her by most. Polly Chalmers was considered by most Castle Rock ladies and many of the gentlemen to be eccentric. Polly presented all sorts of problems for the self-appointed social arbiters of Castle Rock. For one thing, no one could quite decide on the most basic fact of all. Was Polly from town, or was she from away? She had been born in Castle Rock, true enough, but she had left with Duke Sheehan's bun in her oven at the age of 18. That had been in 1970, and she had only returned once before moving back for good in 1987. That brief return call had begun in late 1975, when her father had been dying from cancer of the bowel. Following his death, Lorraine Chalmers had suffered a heart attack, and Polly had stayed on to nurse her mother. Lorraine had suffered a second heart attack, this one fatal, in the early spring of 1976, and after her mother had been buried away in Homeland, Polly, who had by then attained a genuine air of mystery as far as the ladies of the town were concerned, had left again. Gone for good this time, had been the general consensus, and when the last remaining Chalmers, old Aunt Evie, died in 1981 and Polly did not attend the funeral, the consensus seemed a proven fact. Yet 4 years ago she had returned and had opened her sewing shop. Although no one knew for certain, it seemed likely that she had used Aunt Evie Chalmers's money to fund the new venture. Who else would that crazy old rip have left it to? The town's more avid followers of La Comédie Humaine, this was most of them, felt sure that if Polly made a success of her little business and stuck around, most of the things they were curious about would be revealed to them in the fullness of time. But in Polly's case, many matters remained dark. It was really quite exasperating. She had spent some of the intervening years in San Francisco. That much was known, but little more. Lorraine Chalmers had been as close as the devil about her wayward daughter. Had Polly gone to school there or somewhere? She ran her business as if she had taken business courses and learned to write smart from them, too, but no one could say for sure. She was single when she returned, but had she ever been married, either in San Francisco or in one of those places where she might, or might not, have spent some of her time between then and now? No one knew that either, only that she had never married the Sheehan boy. He had joined the Marines, had done a few turns there, and was now selling real estate somewhere in New Hampshire. And why had she come back here to stay after all the years? Most of all, they wondered about the baby. Had pretty Polly gotten an abortion? Had she given it up for adoption? Had she kept it? If so, had it died? Was it, maddening pronoun that, alive now, at school somewhere, and writing the occasional letter home to its mother? No one knew these things either, and in many ways the unanswered questions about it were the most galling. The girl who had left on a greyhound with a bun in her oven was now a woman of almost 40, and had been back, living and doing business in town for 4 years, and no one even knew the sex of the child that had caused her to leave. Just lately, Polly Chalmers had given the town a fresh demonstration of her eccentricity, if one was needed. She had begun keeping company with Alan Pangborn, Castle County's sheriff, and Sheriff Pangborn had buried his wife and younger son only a year and a half ago. This behavior was not quite a scandal, but it was certainly eccentric. And so no one was really surprised to see Polly Chalmers go marching down the sidewalk of Main Street from her door to that of Needful Things at 10:02 on the morning of October 9th. They were not even surprised at what she was carrying in her gloved hands, a Tupperware container which could only contain a cake. It was, the locals said when discussing it later, just like her. The display window of Needful Things had been cleansed of soap, and a dozen or so items had been set out there. Clocks, a silver setting, a painting, a lovely triptych just waiting for someone to fill it with well-loved photographs. Polly glanced at these items with approval, then went to the door. The sign hanging there read open. As she did what the sign suggested, a small bell jingled over her head. This had been installed since Brian Rusk's preview. The shop smelled of new carpeting and fresh paint. It was filled with sunshine, and as she stepped in, looking around with interest, a clear thought came to her. This is a success. Not a customer has stepped through the door yet, unless I'm one, and it's already a success. Remarkable. Such hasty judgments were not like her, and neither was her feeling of instant approval, but they were undeniable. A tall man was bending over one of the glass display cases. He looked up when the bell jingled and smiled at her. "Hello," he said. Polly was a practical woman who knew her own mind and generally liked what she found there, and so the instant of confusion which struck her when she first met this stranger's eyes was confusing in and of itself. "I know him," was the first clear thought to come through that unexpected cloud. "I've met this man before." "Where?" She hadn't, though, and that knowledge, that surety, came a moment later. It was déjà vu, she supposed, that sense of false recollection, which strikes almost everyone from time to time, a feeling which is disorienting because it is at once so dreamy and so prosaic. She was put off her stride for a moment or two and could only smile at him lamely. Then she moved her left hand to get a better grip on the cake container she held, and a harsh bolt of pain shot up the back of it and out toward the wrist in two bright spikes. The tines of a large chrome fork seemed to be planted deep in her flesh. It was arthritis, and it hurt like a son of a bitch, but at least it focused her attention again, and she spoke without a noticeable lag. Only she thought that the man might have noticed just the same. He had bright hazel eyes, which looked as if they might notice a great deal. "Hi," she said. "My name is Polly Chalmers. I own the little dress and sewing shop two doors down from you. I thought that, since we're neighbors, I'd come over and welcome you to Castle Rock before the rush." He smiled, and his entire face lit up. She felt an answering smile lift her own lips, even though her left hand was still hurting like a bastard. "If I weren't already in love with Alan," she thought, "I think I'd fall at this man's feet without a whimper. Show me to the bedroom, master. I will go quietly." With a quirk of amusement, she wondered how many of the ladies who would pop in here for a quick peek before the end of the day would go home with ravening crushes on him. She saw he was wearing no wedding band. More fuel to the fire. "I'm delighted to meet you, Ms. Chalmers," he said, coming forward. "I'm Leland Gaunt." He put out his right hand as he approached her, then frowned slightly as she took a small step backward. "I'm sorry," she said. I don't shake hands. Don't think me impolite, please. I have arthritis." She set the Tupperware container on the nearest glass case and raised her hands, which were encased in kid leather gloves. There was nothing freakish about them, but they were clearly misshapen, the left a little more than the right. There were women in town who thought that Polly was actually proud of her disease. Why else, they reasoned, would she be so quick to show it off? The truth was the exact opposite. Though not a vain woman, she was concerned enough about her looks that the ugliness of her hands embarrassed her. She showed them as quickly as she could, and the same thought surfaced briefly, so briefly it almost always went unrecognized, in her mind each time she did. "There, that's over. Now we can get on with whatever else there is." People usually registered some discomposure or embarrassment of their own when she showed them her hands. Gaunt did not. He grasped her upper arm in hands that felt extraordinarily strong and shook that instead. It might have struck her as an inappropriately intimate thing to have done on first acquaintance, but it did not. The gesture was friendly, brief, even rather amusing. All the same, she was glad it was quick. His hands had a dry, unpleasant feel, even through the light fall coat she was wearing. "It must be difficult to run a sewing shop with that particular disability, Miss Chalmers. However do you manage?" It was a question very few people put to her, and, with the exception of Alan, she couldn't remember anyone's ever asking her in such a straightforward way. "I went right on sewing full-time as long as I could," she said. "Grinned and bore it, I suppose you'd say. Now I have half a dozen girls working for me part-time, and I stick mostly to designing. But I still have my good days." This was a lie, but she felt it did no harm, since she told it mostly for her own benefit. "Well, I'm delighted that you came over. I'll tell you the truth. I've got a bad case of stage fright." "Really? Why?" She was even less hasty about judging people than she was of judging places and events, and she was startled, even a little alarmed at how rapidly and naturally she felt at home with this man she had met less than a minute ago. I keep wondering what I'll do if no one comes in. No one at all day long. "They'll come," she said. "They'll want to look at your stock. No one seems to have any idea what a store called Needful Things sells. But even more important, they'll want to look at you. It's just that in a little place like Castle Rock..." "No one wants to seem too eager," he finished for her. "I know. I've had experience of small towns. My rational mind assures me that what you've just said is the absolute truth. But there's another voice that just goes on saying, 'They won't come, Leland, old buddy. Oh, no, they won't come. They'll stay away in droves. You just wait and see.'" She laughed, remembering suddenly that she had felt exactly the same way when she opened You So-and-So. "But what's this?" he asked, touching the Tupperware container with one hand. And she noticed what Brian Rusk had already seen. The first and second fingers of that hand were exactly the same length. "It's a cake, and if I know this town half as well as I think I do, I can assure you it will be the only one you get today." He smiled at her, clearly delighted. "Thank you. Thank you very much, Miss Chalmers. I'm touched." And she, who never asked anyone to use her first name on first or even short acquaintance, and who was suspicious of anyone, realtors, insurance agents, car salesmen, who appropriated that privilege unasked, was bemused to hear herself saying, "If we're going to be neighbors, shouldn't you call me Polly?" The cake was devil's food, as Leland Gaunt ascertained merely by lifting the lid and sniffing. He asked her to stay and have a slice with him. Polly demurred. Gaunt insisted. "You'll have someone to run your shop," he said, "and no one will dare set foot in mine for at least half an hour. That should satisfy the protocols, and I have 1,000 questions about the town." So she agreed. He disappeared through the curtained doorway at the back of the shop, and she heard him climbing stairs. The upstairs area, she supposed, must be his living quarters, if only temporarily, to get plates and forks. While she waited for him to come back, Polly wandered around looking at things. A framed sign on the wall by the door through which she had entered said that the shop would be open from 10 in the morning until 5 in the afternoon on Mondays, Wednesdays, Fridays, and Saturdays. It would be closed, except by appointment, on Tuesdays and Thursdays until late spring. Or, Polly thought, with an interior grin, until those wild and crazy tourists and vacationers arrived again, waving their fistfuls of dollars. Needful Things, she decided, was a curio shop. An upscale curio shop, she would have said after a single glance, but a closer examination of the items for sale suggested it was not that easily categorized. The items which had been placed out when Brian stopped in the afternoon before, geode, Polaroid camera, picture of Elvis Presley, the few others, were still there, but perhaps 4 dozen more had been added. A small rug, probably worth a small fortune, hung on one of the off-white walls. It was Turkish and old. There was a collection of lead soldiers in one of the cases, possibly antiques, but Polly knew that all lead soldiers, even those cast in Hong Kong a week ago last Monday, have an antique-y look. The goods were wildly varied. Between the picture of Elvis, which looked to her like the sort of thing that would retail on any carnival midway in America for $4.99, and a singularly uninteresting American Eagle weather vane, was a carnival glass lampshade, which was certainly worth $800 and might be worth as much as $5,000. A battered and charmless teapot stood flanked by a pair of gorgeous poupées, and she could not even begin to guess what those beautiful French dollies with their rouged cheeks and gartered gams might be worth. There was a selection of baseball and tobacco cards, a fan of pulp magazines from the 30s, weird tales, astounding tales, thrilling wonder stories, a table radio from the 50s, which was that disgusting shade of pale pink which the people of that time seemed to approve of when it came to appliances, if not to politics. Most, although not all, of the items had small plaques standing in front of them. Tri-Crystal Geode, Arizona, read one. Custom Socket Wrench Kit, read another. The one in front of the splinter, which had so amazed Brian, announced it was Petrified Wood from the Holy Land. The plaques in front of the trading cards and pulp magazines read, "Others available upon request." All the items, whether trash or treasure, had one thing in common, she observed. There were no price tags on any of them. Gaunt arrived back with two small plates, plain old Corningware, nothing fancy, a cake knife, and a couple of forks. "Everything's helter-skelter up there," he confided, removing the top of the container and setting it aside. He turned it upside down so it would not imprint a ring of frosting on the top of the cabinet he was serving from. "I'll be looking for a house as soon as I get things set to rights here, but for the time being, I'm going to live over the store. Everything's in cardboard cartons. God, I hate cardboard cartons." "Who would you say..." "Not that big," Polly protested. "My goodness!" "Okay," Gaunt said cheerfully, putting the thick slab of chocolate cake on one of the plates. "This one will be mine. Eat, Ralph. Eat, I say. Like this for you? Even thinner." "I can't cut it any thinner than this," he said, and sliced off a narrow piece of cake. "It smells heavenly. Thank you again, Polly." "You're more than welcome." It did smell good, and she wasn't on a diet, but her initial refusal had been more than first meeting politeness. The last 3 weeks had been a stretch of gorgeous Indian summer weather in Castle Rock, but on Monday the weather had turned cool, and her hands were miserable with the change. The pain would probably abate a little once her joints got used to the cooler temperatures, or so she prayed, and so it had always been, but she was not blind to the progressive nature of the disease. But since early this morning, it had been very bad. When it was like this, she was never sure what she would or would not be able to do with her traitor hands, and her initial refusal had been out of worry and potential embarrassment. Now she stripped off her gloves, flexed her right hand experimentally. A spear of hungry pain bolted up her forearm to the elbow. She flexed again, her lips compressed in anticipation. The pain came, but it wasn't as intense this time. She relaxed a little. It was going to be all right. Not great. Not as pleasant as eating cake should be, but all right. She picked up her fork carefully, bending her fingers as little as possible when she grasped it. As she conveyed the first bite to her mouth, she saw Gaunt looking at her sympathetically. "Now he'll commiserate," she thought glumly, "and tell me how bad his grandfather's arthritis was, or his ex-wife's, or somebody's." But Gaunt did not commiserate. He took a bite of cake and rolled his eyes comically. "Never mind sewing and patterns," he said. "You should have opened a restaurant." "Oh, I didn't make it," she said, "but I'll convey the compliment to Nettie Cobb. She's my housekeeper." "Nettie Cobb," he said thoughtfully, cutting another bite from his slice of cake. "Yes. Do you know her?" "Oh, I doubt it." He spoke with the air of a man who is suddenly recalled to the present moment. "I don't know anyone in Castle Rock." He looked at her slyly from the corners of his eyes. "Any chance she could be hired away?" "None," Polly said, laughing. "I was going to ask you about real estate agents," he said. "Who would you say is the most trustworthy around here?" "Oh, they're all thieves, but Mark Hopewell's probably as safe as any." He choked back laughter and put a hand to his mouth to stifle a spray of crumbs. Then he began to cough, and if her hands hadn't been so painful, she would have thumped him companionably on the back a few times. First acquaintance or not, she didn't like him. "Sorry," he said, still chuckling a little. "They are all thieves, though, aren't they?" "Oh, absolutely." Had she been another sort of woman, one who kept the facts of her own past less completely to herself, Polly would then have begun asking Leland Gaunt leading questions. Why had he come to Castle Rock? Where had he been before coming here? Would he stay long? Did he have a family? But she wasn't that other sort of woman, and so she was content to answer his questions, was delighted to, in fact, since none of them were about herself. He wanted to know about the town and what the flow of traffic was like on Main Street during the winter, and if there was a place nearby where he could shop for a nice little Yodel stove, and insurance rates, and 100 other things. He produced a narrow black leather notebook from the pocket of the blue blazer he wore and gravely noted down each name she mentioned. She looked down at her plate and saw that she had finished all of her cake. Her hands still hurt, but they felt better than they had when she arrived. She recalled that she had almost decided against coming by because they were so miserable. Now she was glad she had done it anyway. I have to go, she said, looking at her watch. Rosalie will think I died. They had eaten standing up. Now Gaunt stacked their plates neatly, put the forks on top, and replaced the top on the cake container. I'll return this as soon as the cake is gone, he said. Is that all right? Perfectly. You'll probably have it by mid-afternoon then, he said gravely. You don't have to be that prompt, she said as Gaunt walked her to the door. It's been very nice to meet you. Thanks for coming by, he said. For a moment she thought he meant to take her arm, and she felt a sense of dismay at the thought of his touch. Silly, of course, but he didn't. You've made what I expected to be a scary day into something of a treat instead. You'll be fine. Polly opened the door, then paused. She had asked him nothing at all about himself, but she was curious about one thing. Too curious to leave without asking. You've got all sorts of interesting things. Thank you. But nothing is priced. Why is that? He smiled. That's a little eccentricity of mine, Polly. I've always believed that a sale worth making is worth dickering over a little. I think I must have been a Middle Eastern rug merchant in my last incarnation. So, you charge whatever the market will bear, she asked, teasing just a little. You could say so, he agreed seriously, and again she was struck by how deep his hazel eyes were, how oddly beautiful. I'd rather think of it as defining worth, by need. I see. Do you really? Well, I think so. It explains the name of the shop. He smiled. It might, he said. I suppose it might, at that. Well, I'll wish you a very good day, Mr. Gaunt. Leland, please. Or just Lee. Leland, then. And you're not to worry about customers. I think by Friday you'll have to hire a security guard to shoo them out at the end of the day. Do you? That would be lovely. Goodbye. Ciao, he said, and closed the door after her. He stood there a moment, watching as Polly Chalmers walked down the street, smoothing her gloves over her hands, so misshapen, and in such startling contrast to the rest of her, which was trim and pretty, if not terribly remarkable. Gaunt's smile grew. As his lips drew back, exposing his uneven teeth, it became unpleasantly predatory. You'll do, he said softly in the empty shop. You'll do just fine. Polly's prediction proved quite correct. By closing time that day, almost all of the women in Castle Rock, those who mattered anyway, and several men had stopped by Needful Things for a quick browse. Almost all of them were at some pains to assure Gaunt that they only had a moment because they were on their way to someplace else. Stephanie Bonsaint, Cynthia Rose Martin, Barbara Miller, and Francine Pelletier were the first. Steffi, Cindy Rose, Babs, and Francie arrived in a protective bunch not 10 minutes after Polly was observed leaving the new shop. The news of her departure spread quickly and thoroughly by telephone and the efficient bush telegraph which runs through New England backyards. Steffi and her friends looked. They oohed and aahed. They assured Gaunt they could not stay long because this was their bridge day, neglecting to tell him that the weekly rubber usually did not start until about 2 in the afternoon. Francie asked him where he came from. Gaunt told her Akron, Ohio. Steffi asked him if he had been in the antiques business for long. Gaunt told her he did not consider it to be the antiques business, exactly. Cindy wanted to know if Mr. Gaunt had been in New England long. A while, Gaunt replied. A while. All four agreed later that the shop was interesting, so many odd things, but it had been a very unsuccessful interview. The man was as closed-mouthed as Polly Chalmers, perhaps more. Babs then pointed out what they all knew, or thought they knew, that Polly had been the first person in town to actually enter the new shop and that she had brought a cake. Perhaps, Babs speculated, she knew Mr. Gaunt from that time before, that time she had spent away. Cindy Rose expressed interest in a Lalique vase and asked Mr. Gaunt, who was nearby but did not hover, all noted with approval, how much it was. "How much do you think?" he asked, smiling. She smiled back at him rather coquettishly. "Oh," she said, "is that the way you do things, Mr. Gaunt?" "That's the way I do them," he agreed. "Well, you're apt to lose more than you gain, dickering with Yankees," Cindy Rose said, while her friends looked on with the bright interest of spectators at a Wimbledon championship match. "That," he said, "remains to be seen." His voice was still friendly, but now it was mildly challenging as well. Cindy Rose looked more closely at the vase this time. Steffi Bonsaint whispered something in her ear. Cindy Rose nodded. $17, she said. The vase actually looked as if it might be worth 50, and she guessed that in a Boston antique shop it would be priced at 180. Gaunt steepled his fingers under his chin in a gesture Brian Rusk would have recognized. "I think I'd have to have at least 45, he said with some regret. Cindy Rose's eyes brightened. There were possibilities here. She had originally seen the Lalique vase as something only mildly interesting, really not much more than another conversational crowbar to use on the mysterious Mr. Gaunt. Now she looked at it more closely and saw that it really was a nice piece of work, one which would look right at home in her living room. The border of flowers around the long neck of the vase was the exact color of her wallpaper. Until Gaunt had responded to her suggestion with a price which was only a finger's length out of her reach, she hadn't realized that she wanted the vase as badly as she now felt that she did. She consulted with her friends. Gaunt watched them, smiling gently. The bell over the door rang, and two more ladies came in. At Needful Things, the first full day of business had begun. When the Ash Street Bridge Club left Needful Things 10 minutes later, Cindy Rose Martin carried a shopping bag by the handles. Inside was the Lalique vase, wrapped in tissue paper. She had purchased it for $31 plus tax, almost all of her pin money, but she was so delighted with it that she was almost purring. Usually, she felt doubtful and a little ashamed of herself after such an impulse buy, certain that she had been cozened a little, if not cheated outright, but not today. This was one deal where she had come out on top. Mr. Gaunt had even asked her to come back, saying he had the twin of this vase and it would be arriving in a shipment later in the week, perhaps even tomorrow. This one would look lovely on the little table in her living room, but if she had two, she could put one on each end of the mantle, and that would be smashing. Her three friends also felt that she had done well, and although they were a little frustrated at having gotten so little of Mr. Gaunt's background, their opinion of him was, on the whole, quite high. "He's got the most beautiful green eyes," Francie Pelletier said, a little dreamily. "Were they green?" Cindy Rose asked, a little startled. She herself had thought they were gray. "I didn't notice." Late that afternoon, Rosalie Drake from You So-and-So stopped in Needful Things on her coffee break, accompanied by Polly's housekeeper, Nettie Cobb. There were several women browsing in the store, and in the rear corner, two boys from Castle County High were leafing through a cardboard carton of comic books and muttering excitedly to each other. It was amazing, they both agreed, how many of the items they needed to fill their respective collections were here. They only hoped the prices would not prove too high. It was impossible to tell without asking because there were no price stickers on the plastic bags which held the comics. Rosalie and Polly said hello to Mr. Gaunt, and Gaunt asked Rosalie to thank Polly again for the cake. His eyes followed Nettie, who had wandered away after the introductions and was looking rather wistfully at a small collection of carnival glass. He left Rosalie studying the picture of Elvis next to the splinter of petrified wood from the Holy Land and walked over to Nettie. "Do you like carnival glass, Ms. Cobb?" he asked softly. She jumped a little. Nettie Cobb had the face and almost painfully shy manner of a woman made to jump at voices, no matter how soft and friendly, when they spoke from the general area of her elbow, and smiled at him nervously. "It's Mrs. Cobb, Mr. Gaunt, although my husband's been passed on for some time now. I am sorry to hear it. No need to be. It's been 14 years. Long time. Yes, I have a little collection of carnival glass. She seemed almost to quiver, as a mouse might quiver at the approach of a cat. Not that I could afford anything so nice as these pieces. Lovely they are, like things must look in heaven. Well, I'll tell you something, he said. I bought quite a lot of carnival glass when I got these, and they're not as expensive as you might think, and the others are much nicer. Would you like to come by tomorrow and have a look at them? She jumped again and sidled away a step, as if he had suggested she might like to come by the next day so he could pinch her bottom a few times, perhaps until she cried. Oh, I don't think. Thursday's my busy day, you know, at Polly's. We really have to turn the place out on Thursdays, you know. Are you sure you can't drop by? He coaxed. Polly told me that you made the cake she brought this morning. Was it all right? Nettie asked nervously. Her eyes said she expected him to say, no, it was not all right, Nettie. It gave me cramps. It gave me the backdoor trots, in fact. And so I'm going to hurt you, Nettie. I'm going to drag you into the back room and twist your nipples until you holler, Uncle. It was wonderful, he said soothingly. It made me think of the cakes my mother used to make, and that was a very long time ago. This was the right note to strike with Nettie, who had loved her own mother dearly in spite of the beatings that lady had administered after her frequent nights out in the juke joints and gin mills. She relaxed a little. Well, that's fine then, she said. I'm awfully glad it was good. Of course, it was Polly's idea. She's just about the sweetest woman in the world. Yes, he said. After meeting her, I can believe that. He glanced at Rosalie Drake, but Rosalie was still browsing. He looked back at Nettie and said, I just felt I owed you a little something. Oh, no, Nettie said, alarmed all over again. You don't owe me a thing, not a single solitary thing, Mr. Gaunt. Please, come by. I can see you have an eye for carnival glass, and I could give you back Polly's cake box. Well, I suppose I could drop by on my break. Nettie's eyes said she could not believe what she was hearing from her own mouth. Wonderful, he said, and left her quickly before she could change her mind again. He walked over to the boys and asked them how they were doing. They hesitantly showed him several old issues of The Incredible Hulk and The X-Men. 5 minutes later, they went out with most of the comic books in their hands and expressions of stunned joy on their faces. The door had barely shut behind them when it opened again. Cora Rusk and Myra Evans strode in. They looked around, eyes as bright and avid as those of squirrels in nut-gathering season, and went immediately to the glass case containing the picture of Elvis. Cora and Myra bent over, cooing with interest, displaying bottoms which were easily 2 axe handles wide. Gaunt watched them, smiling. The bell over the door jingled again. The new arrival was as large as Cora Rusk, but Cora was fat, and this woman looked strong, the way a lumberjack with a beer belly looks strong. A large white button had been pinned to her blouse. The red letters proclaimed, Casino Night, just for fun. The lady's face had all the charm of a snow shovel. Her hair, an unremarkable and lifeless shade of brown, was mostly covered by a kerchief which was knotted severely under her wide chin. She surveyed the interior of the store for a moment or two, her small, deep-set eyes flicking here and there, like the eyes of a gunslinger who surveys the interior of a saloon before pushing all the way through the batwing doors and starting to raise hell. Then she came in. Few of the women circulating among the displays gave her more than a glance, but Nettie Cobb looked up at the newcomer with an extraordinary expression of mingled dismay and hate. Then she scuttled away from the carnival glass. Her movement caught the newcomer's eye. She glanced at Nettie with a kind of massive contempt, then dismissed her. The bell over the door jingled as Nettie left the shop. Mr. Gaunt observed all this with great interest. He walked over to Rosalie and said, Mrs. Cobb has left without you, I'm afraid. Rosalie looked startled. Why, she began, and then her eyes settled on the newcomer with the casino night button pinned adamantly between her breasts. She was studying the Turkish rug hung on the wall with the fixed interest of an art student in a gallery. Her hands were planted on her vast hips. "Oh," Rosalie said, "excuse me, I really ought to go along." "No love lost between those two, I'd say," Mr. Gaunt remarked. Rosalie smiled distractedly. Gaunt glanced at the woman in the kerchief again. "Who is she?" Rosalie wrinkled her nose. "Wilma Jurzik," she said. "Excuse me, I really ought to catch up with Nettie. She's high-strung, you know." "Of course," he said, and watched Rosalie out the door. To himself, he added, "Aren't we all?" Then Cora Rusk was tapping him on the shoulder. "How much is that picture of the king?" she demanded. Leland Gaunt turned his dazzling smile upon her. "Well, let's talk about it," he said. "How much do you think it's worth?" Castle Rock's newest port of commerce had been closed for nearly 2 hours when Alan Pangborn rolled slowly down Main Street toward the municipal building, which housed the sheriff's office and the Castle Rock Police Department. He was behind the wheel of the ultimate unmarked car, a 1986 Ford Town and Country station wagon, the family car. He felt low and half drunk. He'd only had 3 beers, but they'd hit him hard. He glanced at Needful Things as he drove past, approving of the dark green canopy which jutted out over the street, just as Brian Rusk had done. He knew less about such things, having no relations who worked for the Dick Perry Siding and Door Company in South Paris, but he thought it did lend a certain touch of class to Main Street, where most shop owners had added false fronts and called it good. He didn't know yet what the new place sold, Pollywood, if she had gone over this morning as she had planned, but it looked to Alan like one of those cozy French restaurants where you took the girl of your dreams before trying to sweet-talk her into bed. The place slipped from his mind as soon as he passed it. He signaled left a block farther down and turned up the narrow passage between the squat brick block of the municipal building and the white clapboard water district building. This lane was marked Official Vehicles Only. The municipal building was shaped like an upside-down L, and there was a small parking lot in the angle formed by the 2 wings. 3 of the slots were marked Sheriff's Office. Norris Ridgwick's bumbling old VW Beetle was parked in one of them. Alan parked in another, cut the headlights and the motor, reached for the door handle. The depression, which had been circling him ever since he left the Blue Door in Portland, circling the way wolves often circled campfires in the adventure stories he had read as a boy, suddenly fell upon him. He let go of the door handle and just sat behind the wheel of the station wagon, hoping it would pass. He had spent the day in Portland's district court, testifying for the prosecution in 4 straight trials. The district encompassed 4 counties, York, Cumberland, Oxford, Castle, and of all the lawmen who served in those counties, Alan Pangborn had the furthest to travel. The 3 district judges therefore tried as best they could to schedule his court cases in bunches, so he would have to make the trip only once or twice a month. This made it possible for him to actually spend some time in the county which he had sworn to protect, instead of on the roads between Castle Rock and Portland, but it also meant that, after one of his court days, he felt like a high school kid stumbling out of the auditorium where he had just taken the scholastic aptitude tests. He should have known better than to drink on top of that, but Harry Cross and George Crompton had just been on their way down to the Blue Door, and they had insisted that Alan join them. There had been a good enough reason to do so, a string of clearly related burglaries which had occurred in all their areas. But the real reason he had gone was the one most bad decisions have in common. It had seemed like a good idea at the time. Now he sat behind the wheel of what had been the family car, reaping what he had sown of his own free will. His head ached gently. He felt more than a touch of nausea, but the depression was the worst. It was back with a vengeance. "Hello!" it cried merrily from its stronghold inside his head. Here I am, Alan. Good to see you. Guess what? Here it is, end of a long, hard day, and Annie and Todd are still dead. Remember the Saturday afternoon when Todd spilled his milkshake on the front seat? Right under where your briefcase is now, wasn't it? And you shouted at him? Wow! Didn't forget that, did you? You did? Well, that's okay, Alan, because I'm here to remind you. And remind you. And remind you. He lifted his briefcase and looked fixedly at the seat. Yes, the stain was there, and yes, he had shouted at Todd. Todd, why do you always have to be so clumsy? Something like that, no big deal, but not the sort of thing you would ever say if you knew your kid had less than a month to live. It occurred to him that the beers weren't the real problem. It was this car, which had never been properly cleaned out. He had spent the day riding with the ghosts of his wife and his younger son. He leaned over and popped the glove compartment to get his citation book. Carrying that, even when he was headed down to Portland to spend the day testifying in court, was an unbreakable habit, and reached inside. His hand struck some tubular object, and it fell out onto the floor of the station wagon with a little thump. He put his citation book on top of his briefcase and then bent over to get whatever it was he had knocked out of the glove compartment. He held it up so it caught the glow of the arc sodium light and stared at it for a long time, feeling the old dreadful ache of loss and sorrow steal into him. Polly's arthritis was in her hands. His, it seemed, was in his heart, and who could say which of them had gotten the worst of it? The can had belonged to Todd, of course, Todd, who would have undoubtedly lived in the Auburn novelty shop if he had been allowed. The boy had been entranced with the cheap jack arcana sold there. Joy buzzers, sneezing powder, dribble glasses, soap that turned the user's hands to the color of volcanic ash, plastic dog turds. This thing is still here. 19 months they've been dead, and it's still here. How in hell did I miss it? Christ! Alan turned the round can over in his hands, remembering how the boy had pleaded to be allowed to buy this particular item with his allowance money, how Alan himself had demurred, quoting his own father's proverb, "The fool and his money soon parted," and how Annie had overruled him in her gentle way. "Listen to you, Mr. Amateur Magician, sounding like a Puritan. I love it. Where do you think he got this insane love of gags and tricks in the first place? No one in my family ever kept a framed picture of Houdini on the wall, believe me. Do you want to tell me you didn't buy a dribble glass or two in the hot, wild days of your youth? That you wouldn't have just about died to own the old snake in the can of nuts trick if you'd come across one in a display case somewhere?" He, hemming and hawing, sounding more and more like a pompous stuffed shirt windbag. Finally, he had had to raise a hand to his mouth to hide a grin of embarrassment. Annie had seen it, however. Annie always did. That had been her gift, and more than once, it had been his salvation. Her sense of humor, and her sense of perspective as well, had always been better than his. Sharper. "Let him have it, Alan. He'll only be young once, and it is sort of funny." So he had. And 3 weeks after that, he spilled his milkshake on the seat, and 4 weeks after that, he was dead. They were both dead. Wow! Imagine that! Time surely does fly by, doesn't it, Alan? But don't worry. Don't worry, because I'll keep reminding you. Yes, sir, I'll keep reminding you, because that's my job, and I mean to do it. The can was labeled Tasty Munch Mixed Nuts. Alan twisted off the top, and 5 feet of compressed green snake leaped out, struck the windshield, and rebounded into his lap. Alan looked at it, heard his dead son's laughter inside his head, and began to cry. His weeping was undramatic, silent, and exhausted. It seemed that his tears had a lot in common with the possessions of his dead loved ones. You never got to the end of them. There were too many, and just when you started to relax and think that it was finally over, the joint was clean, you found one more, and one more, and one more. Why had he let Todd buy the goddamn thing? Why was it still in the goddamn glove compartment? And why had he taken the goddamn town and country wagon in the first place? He pulled his handkerchief out of his back pocket and mopped the tears from his face. Then, slowly, he jammed the snake, just cheap green crepe paper with a metal spring wound up inside it, back into the bogus mixed nuts can. He screwed on the top and bounced the can thoughtfully on his hand. Throw the goddamn thing away. But he didn't think he could do that. Not tonight, at least. He tossed the joke, the last one Todd had ever bought in what he considered the world's finest store, back into the glove compartment and slammed the hatch shut. Then he took hold of the door handle again, grabbed his briefcase, and got out. He breathed deeply of the early evening air, hoping it would help. It didn't. He could smell decomposed wood and chemicals, a charmless odor which drifted down regularly from the paper mills in Rumford, some 30 miles north. He would call Polly and ask her if he could come over, he decided. That would help a little. A truer thought was never thunk, the voice of depression agreed energetically. And by the way, Alan, do you remember how happy that snake made him? He tried it on everyone. Just about scared Norris Ridgwick into a heart attack, and you laughed until you almost wet your pants. Remember? Wasn't he lively? Wasn't he great? And Annie, remember how she laughed when you told her? She was lively and great, too, wasn't she? Of course, she wasn't quite as lively at the very end. Not quite as great, either, but you didn't really notice, did you? Because you had your own fish to fry. The business with Thad Beaumont, for instance. You really couldn't get that off your mind. What happened at their house by the lake and how, after it was all over, he used to get drunk and call you. And then his wife took the twins and left him. All of that added to the usual around-town stuff kept you pretty busy, didn't it? Too busy to see what was happening right at home. Too bad you didn't see it. If you had, why, they might still be alive. That's something you shouldn't forget either, and so I'll just keep reminding you, and reminding you, and reminding you, okay? Okay! There was a foot-long scratch along the side of the wagon, just above the gasoline port. Had that happened since Annie and Todd died? He couldn't really remember, and it didn't matter much anyway. He traced his fingers along it, and reminded himself again to take the car to Sonny Sunoco and get it fixed. On the other hand, why bother? Why not just take the damn thing down to Harry Ford in Oxford and trade it in on something smaller? The mileage on it was still relatively low. He could probably get a decent trade-in. But Todd spilled his milkshake on the front seat, the voice in his head piped up indignantly. He did that when he was alive, Alan, old buddy. And Annie... Oh, shut up, he said. He reached the building, then paused. Parked close by... so close that the office door would have dented in its side if pulled all the way open, was a large red Cadillac Seville. He didn't need to look at the license plates to know what they were. Keaton 1. He ran a hand thoughtfully over the car's smooth hide, then went in. Sheila Brigham was sitting in the glass-walled dispatcher's cubicle reading People magazine and drinking a Yoo-Hoo. The combined sheriff's office, Castle Rock Police Department, was otherwise deserted except for Norris Ridgwick. Norris sat behind an old IBM electric typewriter, working on a report with the agonized, breathless concentration only Norris could bring to paperwork. He would stare fixedly at the machine, then abruptly lean forward like a man who has been punched in the belly, and hit the keys in a rattling burst. He remained in his hunched position long enough to read what he had written, then groaned softly. There was the click-rap, click-rap, click-rap sound of Norris using the IBM's correct tape to back over some error. He used one correct tape per week on the average. And then Norris would straighten up. There would be a pregnant pause, and then the cycle would repeat itself. After an hour or so of this, Norris would drop the finished report into Sheila's in basket. Once or twice a week, these reports were even intelligible. Norris looked up and smiled as Alan crossed the small bullpen area. Hi, boss. How's it going? Well, Portland's out of the way for another 2 or 3 weeks. Anything happen here? Nah, just the usual. You know, Alan, your eyes are red as hell. Have you been smoking that wacky tobacco again? Ha ha, Alan said sourly. I stopped for a couple of drinks with a couple of cops, then stared at people's high beams for 30 miles. You got your aspirin handy? Always, Norris said. You know that. Norris's bottom desk drawer contained his own private pharmacy. He opened it, rummaged, produced a giant-sized bottle of strawberry-flavored Kaopectate, stared at the label for a moment, shook his head, dropped it back into the drawer, and rummaged some more. At last, he produced a bottle of generic aspirin. "I've got a little job for you," Alan said, taking the bottle and shaking two aspirins into his hand. A lot of white dust fell out with the pills, and he found himself wondering why generic aspirin always produced more dust than brand-name aspirin. He wondered further if he might be losing his mind. "Ah, Alan, I got two more of these E9 boogers to do, and..." "Cool your jets." Alan went to the water cooler and pulled a paper cup from the cylinder screwed to the wall. "Blub, blub, blub," went the water cooler as he filled the cup. "All you've got to do is cross the room and open the door I just came through. So simple, even a child could do it, right?" "What?" "Only, don't forget to take your citation book," Alan said, and gulped the aspirin down. Norris Ridgwick immediately looked wary. "Yours is right there on the desk, next to your briefcase." "I know, and that's where it's going to stay, at least for tonight." Norris looked at him for a long time. Finally, he asked, "Buster?" Alan nodded. "Buster. He's parked in the goddamn crypt space again. I told him last time I was through warning him about it." Castle Rock's head selectman, Danforth Keaton III, was referred to as Buster by all who knew him. But municipal employees who wanted to hold on to their jobs made sure to call him Dan or Mr. Keaton when he was around. Only Alan, who was an elected official, dared call him Buster to his face, and he had done it only twice, both times when he was very angry. He supposed he would do it again, however. Dan Buster Keaton was a man Alan Pangborn found it very easy to get angry at. "Come on," Norris said. "You do it, Alan, okay?" "Can't. I've got that appropriations meeting with the selectman next week." "He hates me already," Norris said morbidly. "I know he does." "Buster hates everyone except his wife and his mother," Alan said, "and I'm not so sure about his wife. But the fact remains that I have warned him at least half a dozen times in the last month about parking in our one and only handicapped space, and now I'm going to put my money where my mouth is." "No, I'm going to put my job where your mouth is. This is really mean, Alan. I'm sincere." Norris Ridgwick looked like an ad for When Bad Things Happen to Good People. "Relax," Alan said. "You put a $5 parking ticket on his windshield, he comes to me, and first he tells me to fire you." Norris moaned. "I refuse. Then he tells me to tear up the ticket. I refuse that, too. Then, tomorrow noon, after he's had a chance to froth at the mouth about it for a while, I relent. And when I go into the next appropriations meeting, he owes me a favor."
"Yeah, but what does he owe me?"
"Norris, do you want a new pulse radar gun or not?"
"Well..."
"And what about a fax machine? We've been talking about a fax machine for at least 2 years."
"Yes!" the falsely cheerful voice in his mind cried. "You started talking about it when Annie and Todd were still alive, Alan. Remember that? Remember when they were still alive?"
"I guess," Norris said. He reached for his citation book with sadness and resignation writ large upon his face. "Good man," Alan said with a heartiness he didn't feel. "I'll be in my office for a while." He closed the door and dialed Polly's number. "Hello?" she asked, and he knew immediately that he would not tell her about the depression which had come over him with such smooth completeness. Polly had her own problems tonight. It had taken only that single word to tell him how it was with her. The L sounds in hello were lightly slurred. That only happened when she had taken a Percodan, or perhaps more than one, and she took a Percodan only when the pain was very bad. Although she had never come right out and said so, Alan had an idea she lived in terror of the day when the perks would stop working. "How are you, pretty lady?" he asked, leaning back in his chair and putting a hand over his eyes. The aspirin didn't seem to be doing much for his head. "Maybe I should ask her for a perk," he thought. "I'm all right." He heard the careful way she was speaking, going from one word to the next, like a woman using stepping stones to cross a small stream. "How about you? You sound tired." "Lawyers do that to me every time." He shelved the idea of going over to see her. She would say, "Of course, Alan," and she would be glad to see him, almost as glad as he would be to see her. But it would put more strain on her than she needed this evening. I think I'll go home and turn in early. Do you mind if I don't come by?
No, honey, it might be a little better if you didn't, actually.
Is it bad tonight?
It's been worse, she said carefully.
That's not what I asked.
Not too bad, no.
Your own voice says you're a liar, my dear, he thought.
Good. What's the deal on that ultrasonic therapy you told me about? Find anything out? Well, it would be great if I could afford a month and a half in the Mayo Clinic, on spec, but I can't. And don't tell me you can, Alan, because I'm feeling a little too tired to call you a liar. I thought you said Boston Hospital.
Next year, Polly said. They're going to run a clinic using ultrasound therapy next year. Maybe.
There was a moment of silence, and he was about to say goodbye when she spoke again. This time her tone was a little brighter. I dropped by the new shop this morning. I had Nettie make a cake and took that. Pure orneriness, of course. Ladies don't take baked goods to openings. It's practically graven in stone.
What's it like? What does he sell?
A little bit of everything. If you put a gun to my head, I'd say it's a curios and collectibles shop, but it really defies description. You'll have to see it for yourself.
Did you meet the owner?
Mr. Leland Gaunt from Akron, Ohio, Polly said, and now Alan could actually hear the hint of a smile in her voice. He's going to be quite the heartthrob in Castle Rock Smart Set this year. That's my prediction anyway.
What did you make of him?
When she spoke again, the smile in her voice came through even more clearly. Well, Alan, let me be honest. You're my darling, and I hope I'm yours, but you are, he said. His headache was lifting a little. He doubted if it was Norris Ridgwick's aspirin working this small miracle. But he made my heart go pity-pat, too, and you should have seen Rosalie and Nettie when they came back.
Nettie?
He took his feet off the desk and sat up. Nettie scared of her own shadow.
Yes, but since Rosalie persuaded her to go down with her, you know the poor old dear won't go anywhere alone, I asked Nettie what she thought of Mr. Gaunt after I got home this afternoon.
Alan, her poor old muddy eyes just lit up. He's got carnival glass, she said. Beautiful carnival glass. He even invited me to come back tomorrow and look at some more. I think it's the most she said to me all at once in about 4 years. So I said, wasn't that kind of him, Nettie? And she said, yes, and do you know what?
I asked her what, of course, and Nettie said, and I just might go.
Alan laughed loud and heartily. If Nettie's willing to go see him without a duenna, I ought to check him out. The guy must really be a charmer.
Well, it's funny. He's not handsome, or at least not in a movie star way, but he's got the most gorgeous hazel eyes. They light up his whole face.
Watch it, lady, Alan growled. My jealous muscle is starting to twitch. She laughed a little. I don't think you have to worry. There's one other thing, though.
What's that?
Rosalie said Wilma Jerzyk came in while Nettie was there.
Did anything happen? Were words passed?
No. Nettie glared at the Jerzyk woman, and she kind of curled her lip at Nettie, that's how Rosalie put it, and then Nettie scurried out. Has Wilma Jerzyk called you about Nettie's dog lately?
No, Alan said. No reason to.
I've cruised past Nettie's house after 10 half a dozen nights over the last 6 weeks or so. The dog doesn't bark anymore. It was just the kind of thing puppies do, Polly. It's grown up a little, and it has a good mistress. Nettie may be short a little furniture on the top floor, but she's done her duty by that dog. What does she call it?
Raider.
Well, Wilma Jerzyk will just have to find something else to bitch about because Raider is squared away. She will, though. Ladies like Wilma always do. It was never the dog anyway, not really. Wilma was the only person in the whole neighborhood who complained. It was Nettie. People like Wilma have noses for weakness, and there's a lot to smell on them.